Hey, welcome to the Art Victor podcast. So today's episode is going to be featuring Denise Maroney. And Denise is going to be examining the sericulture and silk industry of Lebanon of the 18th and 19th century. Her presentation is entitled Seasons of Glory. She's going to be talking about the industry and its eventual downfall. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Art Victor, everybody. If you've just joined us, please introduce yourself in the chat. Today, we're very lucky. We have Denise Maroney from both Beirut and New York, now New York, lucky us. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Denise, and she's going to take us through the history of sericulture and the silk industry in Lebanon.
Hi, everybody. Okay, so I'll start with the presenter's promise. Or I should say, actually, so we're starting with my topic is on sericulture in Lebanon. And so just to start off, the term sericulture means the production or the cultivation of silkworms for the production of silk. And Seasons of Glory is a kind of term that alludes to the harvest of silk in Lebanon during the Golden Era. Okay, so beginning with the presenter's promise. So I am not an expert, but I promise that I tried to learn as much as I could to satisfy my curiosity about this topic. Someone here might know more than me about this topic. Please correct me, ask questions, and contribute, but do it nicely. And I'm not trying to persuade you of my agenda or convince you to take action. My only hope is that this presentation will cultivate your own curiosities. So without further ado. So what is the history and legacy of the silk culture in Lebanon? So the next one. Okay, so silk really begins in China. And we don't know exactly where or when it was it started, but we do have an early written record from around 3000 BC, which is during the Huangdi era in China. And it actually, there's a whole charming legend that surrounds how silk began. And it's believed that the wife of the emperor was sitting underneath a mulberry tree having a cup of tea. And suddenly a cocoon dropped inside her teacup. So she reached inside to pick it up. And when she did pick it up, she realized that she had actually caught on to a kind of strand. So she kept pulling and pulling and pulling, and then eventually realized that she had unraveled the cocoon and now had a long piece of thread. So she thought, why not embroider with it or weave with it? And so begins the whole production and the monopoly that China has over sericulture and silk. So, you know, whether you believe the story or not, it is this kind of charming legend that a lot of people refer to when they think about silk. So indeed, China had a monopoly on silk for a long, long time, but eventually secrets started leaking out. And we first start to see silk appearing in Korea, then down in India, and then westward into Persia, and eventually into Byzantium through the silk trade. Okay, so how did silk arrive in the Middle East? Also another charming story. It was believed that Justinian sent spies to China in the form of missionaries. And these missionaries, when they observed how the Chinese were making silk, they essentially kidnapped a couple of cocoons, put them in the tops of their canes, and then brought those all the way back west. And so begins silk production in Byzantium. And this production of silk really centered in what is now Constantinople. And this is where they had a lot of royal workshops, which were essentially factories in which they produced silk, woven and purchased and traded and whatnot. Lebanon itself was not the center of weaving or embroidery or actual production. At that time, and probably the earliest, what Lebanon is known for is the purple dye that was produced from the murex shells. So we had a lot of mollusks, and those were used for dyeing purple. And purple in general was a very hard color to reach in dyes. So this was a very valuable source. And this was what was traded through Syrian traders up into Constantinople. And for this reason, the color purple is usually associated with royalty, with ecclesiastic or religious order. And there were, in fact, laws that required that people only of a certain background were allowed to wear this kind of purple and this kind of material. So it was very controlled, very prized, very valuable. So that was what Lebanon at the time was really known for, this mollusk. So how do we arrive at silk? So essentially, you know, silk production continues through Byzantium, through the Crusades, through the Arab revolts, and we're going forward a lot of years. And once we get to the Ottoman period, we see the beginning of silk production in an informal economy in Lebanon. And really, we can accredit Fakhreddin, also known as the agronomist prince, to developing these informal industries across Mount Lebanon. And in doing so, they were able to really cultivate silk, reel it, and then sell it in local khans, which were then exported to merchants who were coming into Lebanon. And this allowed Mount Lebanon a certain sense of autonomy and, you know, a revenue and income, an economy. And so now we have this setting across Mount Lebanon where we have a lot of homes being used, small sort of informal ateliers developed. And this is where people are reeling and producing silk. So before we go more into history, it's important to understand how actually, what you need to actually make silk. So if you can go to the next slide, we're gonna dive into the process of sericulture, which I really love. So just this picture here is from the Silk Museum in Psus, and it's an old photo. You can see shelves, and in these shelves, there are circular trays of silkworms, and those are where the worms are kept to eat. So underneath them, there's layers of mulberry leaves. So I've written it out here, but just to walk you through from worm to thread. So essentially, you have a moth, and the moth will lay about 500 eggs and then die. And then from these eggs, little worms hatch. And these are the, specifically we're talking about the Bombyx mori, which is the kind of worm that 99.9% of silk is made from. And so this worm emerges and the worm starts to eat. And for about 1 month it eats and eats and eats until it really, you know, I think it sort of could even 8 times its size, or it really becomes fat. And once it's at a certain point, it's ready to go into the pupatory stage, which is when it has these two glands on either sides of its head, and those glands excrete a kind of glue, and that creates this sort of thread, and that's what they use to wind themselves in, and this becomes what we know as a cocoon. So they wind and wind and wind their cocoons, and at this point, if those cocoons are just left alone, eventually the worm inside is going to turn into a butterfly and hatch and fly away, and the whole process starts again. But in silk, in sericulture, those cocoons are taken, the worms are essentially killed through steaming, and then they're dropped into boiling water, and then they're picked up strand by strand, and you can remember, you know, the empress with her boiling cup of tea. They're picked up strand by strand by a kind of machine that then spins them and reels them into skeins of silk, basically bundles of silk. And that is later then dyed and then washed, and then you can sell that for weaving or embroidery or whatsoever. Okay, so then up close, these are actually more modern images of what you saw previously. So the worms, when they're eating, as you can see here on the right, they're on those trays, and then you can also see them on the left, these sort of woven structures that are created to keep the cocoons until they're ready for the next stage. Okay, so again, just to go more depth into the process, so silk reeling, this is a picture on your right, and then on the left there's an actual, this tub is an actual tub that was from the original, and this is actually in the Psus Silk Factory in Lebanon, which is the only remaining factory that's in an actual condition. It's used as a museum. But so this is where there's hot water that's kept, and the cocoons are dropped inside. And this is just like zooming in so you can really see how thin each strand is. So to make one silk thread as we usually know it or see it, you need like 6 or 7 of those strands that are spun together to equal one kind of commercial thread. So in this picture, you can see on the bottom, those are the cocoons that are boiling and then reeled with that round wooden stick. And then it's, if you continue upwards, you'll see the sort of wheel that the woman has, and that's what's allowing her to spin the threads together and extract a thread. In this presentation, and most silk today is actually from Bombyx mori, and there's an example of that silk skein on the left side of this slide, but there are other kinds of silkworms out there. What's important to recognize is that Bombyx mori is a domesticated silkworm, so there is no wild version of that. There are other wild silkworms which are not domesticated. Those are the Tusa, the Muga, and they produce what is usually called as raw silk, which is a bit nubbier, a little bit coarser. The natural color is kind of yellowish, as you can see there. And there's also another kind of silk called Eri, or you might have heard of Ahmisa. This is what they call peace silk because vegans and animal activists like it, essentially, because this kind of worm actually creates like a little hole in the cocoon that it exits. So you don't have to kill a worm to actually reel the silk from the cocoon, hence the peace silk. However, the material, the whole process after that is more like wool, and it's a little bit, again, coarser and just different from the silk as we know it usually. So the other aspect of silk, or the stage of silk cultivation, is the dyeing part. Silk has wonderful luminosity, and so that's great for different, for achieving different shades of color. And so you can see on the bottom, shades of red, for example. And then weaving. So weaving is perhaps one of the most standard applications of silk. And in this picture, this is a kind of footloom woven structures that you would see in Lebanon back in the day. People always ask me this, so I put some fun facts, although I can't really say I know how accurate these are. But for example, one silk tie would take about 110 cocoons to make. One very heavy silk kimono would take up to 3,000 silkworms who are eating 135 pounds of mulberry leaves. So just to give you an idea of perspective and kind of visualizing this whole process and what a silkworm actually yields. So back to the history portion. So under Fakhreddin, we have the development of an informal local economies of silk. But it isn't until the French arrive in the 1800s when the industry really encounters its peak and grows into what we now refer to as the golden era. So to give you some historical context, France in the 1800s underwent the Industrial Revolution. And in 1801 specifically, the Jacquard loom was invented. This is actually the precursor to the modern computer, and it was a big technological advancement that really revolutionized the entire textile industry. It meant that things could be made much quicker with much less actual hands, and it also allowed for a lot of really intricate, complex wovens to be created. So naturally, this kind of advancement led to a lot of revolt and anger from laborers who suddenly found themselves without work. It also meant that they needed a lot more raw silk to actually weave and to keep up with the pace now of production. So in that early 1800s, that's what was happening in France. And at the same time, in the 1830s, there came a huge virus over what's believed to be the trees, the mulberry trees in France. And so a lot of the silkworms got sick, and suddenly France needed to look for a new source for raw production, raw material. So many people went to China, many people went to Japan, and then people went to Lebanon. And that's essentially how the French arrived and how the Golden Era arrived. So the Golden Era, by the way, is loosely from 1840 to 1912 or 1915, essentially World War I. So why Mount Lebanon? So when the French arrived, they already found in Lebanon an informal silk economy. So that was something that was an advantage for them. They found welcoming communities, both Christian and Muslim. They found a lot of cheap labor, aka women. And they found good conditions for growing mulberry trees, which clearly was crucial for any kind of sericulture production, since that is the only thing that the Bombyx mori eats. And then finally, additionally, the location of Mount Lebanon was advantageous because you're right near the water. So they could easily take production into ports and ports shipping directly into France, namely Lyon, which is where the silk weaving industry was. So just again, some more pictures of informal silk production in homes. You can see here on the left, the cocoons that are in a sense rolling into themselves on leaves and branches. And then on the right, a little boy, I believe he's spinning. Yeah, he's spinning. Yes, so this is in 1841, the Portales family arrived in Lebanon and built the first silk factory, which is in Betater in the Shouf region. So this is an old photo of that first factory. Okay, so the impact of sericulture. Okay, so the biggest and one of the biggest impacts is really the social revolution. And essentially, it's the reality that suddenly women were working and leaving their homes to work. So there's even a statistic that by the early 1880s, an estimate 12,000 unmarried women were thought to be working at factories outside of their villages. So why were women hired for this production? For one thing, they were cheap labor. They cost one piaster versus a man who was usually paid 4 to 5 piasters per day. Piaster was the currency back then. Women were thought to kind of fit naturally into this hierarchical structure that was necessary in a factory setting. So you had the man who was the foreman, and below him were all the subordinates, and he needed people to obey. And so women were thought to be to fill that role essentially. And then finally, you know, to do silk, really, you need a lot of patience. You need really nimble fingers and a lot of patience to, you know, extract every single thread and carefully spin it and clean it and whatnot. So women were thought to be more patient, less of a problem, less, you know, likely to challenge working conditions. And so it came to that French and factory owners would literally go looking for women laborers from orphanages, from local villages, and hire them to work. And naturally, this led to a kind of upheaval in society, and it did cause a lot of tensions with local leaders, especially religious leaders, who, you know, were upset probably at the growing amount of women who were engaging in promiscuity and working alongside men and things like that. So again, some more images actually that you can see young girls literally standing in front of the silk reeling areas where they're boiling the silk, and also by the trays of worms.
Look at how white this guy's shoes are.
I know.
Isn't that crazy?
I don't know enough about black and white photography back then, but yeah. Okay, so again, in terms of the impact of silk, silk actually became about 40% of the GDP in Lebanon at its height. And just again, to give you some dates. So in 1867, there were 67 mills. In 85, there were 105 mills. And then up 1913, you have 200 plus mills in Lebanon. And today you have zero in operation. So silk thread exports, 150,000 kilograms of silk thread in the early 1870s and just under 450,000 in the 1890s. This successful industry actually led to the establishment of the first central bank in Beirut. It was created to facilitate all the trade that was happening with this. Sericulture, you know, this industry also led to the fact that French began to be spoken very widely across Lebanon. It allowed for the port of Beirut to really expand and grow. And it even, it led to the creation of USG, which is one of the universities in Lebanon. It was sort of created to counterbalance the Protestants. It was created by the French to counterbalance the Protestants who had just established AUB. Oh, and sorry, in this picture, just to show you, this was later from the 60s, but they did even create a stamp, and I'm sure people can still find it today, honoring Lebanon's silk weavers and reelers. Okay, so the decline. There's several reasons for why this industry, which was so great, just suddenly declined. And so one reason, in 1869, the Suez Canal opened, and so that led to increased trade with China and Japan, who had silk for much, much cheaper. When this happened, they couldn't really compete with the prices that was coming in from the East. And the French had to sell their silk wovens to America, to Europe. And so it was hard for them to, you know, it didn't make sense for them to be basically charging more money for something when they could get it cheaper from the East. So as that develops, that really had an impact in Lebanon and on the trade in Lebanon. There was also fighting. So shocker, just like today, there were lots of skirmishes that were happening between Christians, Druze, Muslims in Mount Lebanon. And so that instability also affected and impacted the decline of the industry. And then in World War I, once the Ottomans joined the side of the Germans, the Allies then created a huge blockade in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so 1914 through 1918, as a result, not only did people not have food, but they also could not trade their silk. They couldn't export silk. So that blockade had a big impact. And you have to remember, at the time, because it was, you know, 40% of the GDP, people were planting a lot of mulberry trees across the country. And while that feeds a silkworm, it definitely doesn't feed a starving human. So there was a real, this monoculture of silk, in a sense, created a scarcity of food. And so with this, people began emigrating, people began starving, and obviously industry was impacted. And then finally in 1915, there was a locust plague, and this just made everything 100% worse. So about a third of the population perished, and many people emigrated, right? So Khalil Gibran, for example, many of us know, that's with a lovely quote, but the great famine of 1959 to 18 led to a lot of emigration. Ironically, or not so, much of these immigrants went to North America, to South America. And in North America, many actually started working in textile mills, which were located mainly in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, and basically the East Coast. So in a sense, they continued to work in that industry. Yes, and so here are some more examples of the mills in America, in New Jersey and Connecticut as well. Okay, so what remains today? There are, I believe, three structures of silk factories that are preserved in Lebanon. One is the Psu Silk Museum, and then one in the Shuf, where they have a lot of parties. Another is a wedding venue. And then actually the another one in the Shuf as well is a photo gallery. So thankfully we have those four preservation efforts. But aside from that, the other mills are really either wrecked, perhaps there's some stones left over, or they're non-existent. There is in Kfar Matta, which is in the next slide here, there is a beautiful factory that I visited last year, and just to show you some pictures, you can see the structures inside these two rows and even an up close of the tables, again, which is where they were, they had the reeling, where the hot water was, where the cocoons went, and where they extracted the silk. Oh, and finally, so there are some people who are still preserving bits of this heritage. And in Zouk Makaya, you can actually meet this one lady. I unfortunately don't remember her name, but I took my students to go see her last year, and she's still weaving in the traditional foot loom manner, using not Lebanese silk thread, definitely probably Chinese, but she continues to produce traditional patterns that are actually woven and then patterned into shoes. So these are the babouche slippers, the designs that she makes.
Great. So I think we have some questions lined up.
Yeah, let me...
I think starting with Hani, right?
Yeah.
Hani, do you want to unmute yourself and talk to us a little bit?
Hi, everybody. I'm Hani. I'm Syrian. I live in New York City. I'm a filmmaker and a photographer. First of all, thank you, Denise, very much. This is very beautiful and energizing, and it brought a lot of good memories. I worked on silk in Syria in 2009, and we ended up making a book. I'll just drop a link in the description, in the chat box. It has a lot of like new photos for the stuff you showed old photos for. Nice. I was about to ask if you know if this is still happening in Lebanon, but I think at the end of your presentation you said it's not there anymore. As far as I know, and the work I'm going to share was done in 2009, so up until then there was like small number of villages in Western Syria where they still like grew silkworms and like, you know, did them the very manual way. There was a form of I think beauty and poetry in it, but at the same time there was a lot of hardship. So I don't really have questions. I'll just share this. I don't know if it will stir any more questions, and I think it will be something for people to look at. And yeah, thank you so much for doing this. And I hope everybody, you know, learned something from the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Wait, sorry, it was a video or is it a book?
It is a book. It is a book. So okay. I think I worked with a friend and she did the research and I did photography. So it was 2009, so that was over 10 years ago, and I'll just drop it. And I think if you'd like to ask me anything,
I'd love to read it.
If you'd like to ask anything, I'll be here, you know, to answer anything about that specific, like, you know, kind of status quo and the industry in Syria in the late 2000s. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks.
Hi, Denise. Can you guys hear me?
I can hear you.
Thanks so much for the presentation. I actually remember one of my first trips in Lebanon. I saw one of those trees and someone showed me the little cocoon. It was in south in what's the name of this very big city in the south? Okay, the question is about the demand. So it was 40% of the GDP. It was exporting a lot of silk. Where was it exporting to? I guess in Europe, since then you talked about Suez and how there was a price arbitrage with so yeah, I would be curious to know who was the main buyers of silk and also maybe the main families in Lebanon, like which you said the Shouf, but was there more communities or yeah?
The factories were mostly in the Shouf and in Mount Lebanon, and it was being exported mainly to Lyon, to France. Lyon was where it was woven. So all the raw material was taken from Lebanon to Lyon where it was woven and then sold to the Western European market. I don't know families actually in Lebanon who are in textiles. I would love to meet them. So if anyone knows that, please by all means share them today.
I had actually just had a question about veganism and if there was outcry about the silk industry, and you kind of answered that with the I forgot which type of silk it was where you're able to still save the silk worm. I'm not personally a vegan, like I was saying in the chat, so I have no insight into this. This is not a leading question. I just didn't know if this was a topic of discussion at all.
Yeah, so it is. And like a hardcore PETA activist would not wear silk. And there are two kinds of silk that are on the market. So Eri, it's ERI silk, and Ahmisa, AHMISA, and both of them actually come from Northeast India, and that's the kind of worm that creates a little hole in the cocoon, so it's like a back door and it exits before you can actually reel the silk. So that is considered vegan-friendly silk. However, it's definitely not, they're not domesticated worms, so there's no industrial production opportunity, and it's very small scale. It's a different field completely from silk as you know it probably. And it's not really regulated. So there are some hardcore PETA activists who will say that this whole peace silk, which is what people refer to it as, is actually not really that peaceful, and that they use like some kind of chemical to, or some way of like freezing the worm to like prolong the length of the silk. So it's a little bit unregulated and perhaps not as benign as one would like it to be.
I'm so glad to have heard your talk, because I've been studying sort of a similar thing. I'm sort of interested in, again, kind of the fallout of the industry as much as what happened at the turn of the 20th century. But one thing I did learn was that in Lyon, when the mulberry trees had their blight, there were a couple of managers that realized that they could take advantage of the industry in Lebanon, but they didn't actually have a foothold at the time. So they sent managers there to talk to the women who were working the factories. And I don't know who this woman was, but I don't think she worked alone, but there were women who stepped up in a leadership role and started to bargain for the other women in the factories. And so they would bargain with the managers, these French managers, and they would get them to the point of a certain salary, and then they duck out and go to another factory down the mountain until they got the wage they wanted. And I'm just curious how much of that you've stumbled upon, and also, does anybody know about when they started to leave the region with these skills and with dollars? There were regular opportunities to leave Beirut on major ship lines, and they went in a variety of directions, and the ones I was following were into Mexico, because I think people don't realize the influence in Mexico. But I'm just trying to find more of the lay of the land of where these skilled workers took their expertise. And so that's what I'm throwing out.
I don't know any good book per se to guide you towards for that. But it's definitely very true that many of them continued working in textiles, whether it was actually funny story is, I worked in Guatemala at a textile mill that was founded originally by a Lebanese man who had left the country in the early 20th century. And so just to show you that example, you know, he left from Lebanon, went to Guatemala, and established what is now actually one of the largest textile industries there. So there's evidence that people did that. I just don't know who's actually, what historian has spent time documenting that, or unfortunately I can't guide you in a direction for that.
Okay. Thank you though. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. I actually, it's not really a question, it's more of a contemplation, and I'm wondering if anyone has any knowledge about this, but this is the first time I've heard about the women working in factories in the silk industry, probably at a time, like you said, that was causing a lot of tensions with the local leaders and with social structures at the time. So I'm kind of wondering how that might have compared to the situation in other countries nearby, like if women were actually included in the labor market back then or not, and whether we can trace any modern day social structures or labor structures, gendered aspects of those, to back then, like how women were actually working in mass numbers in factories versus they might have not been doing that in other countries nearby, and if we can see any differences between countries in that or within Lebanon.
It's a good question, and I actually am not sure. I don't know enough about the neighboring countries and their social structures in that sense. And within Lebanon itself, I don't know, Mikey, Remy, maybe you have more of an idea than I do.
As I understand it, it is the silk industry is credited with allowing women to enter, industrial.
The industrial labor force.
As Jenny was saying, you know, women were always considered part of the labor force for things like, agriculture and things like that. And you still see that today in agricultural societies. You know, you see it in migrant societies, Syrian refugees, like Jenny was saying. You know, women are part of the workforce. But what happened with the silk industry is that gave women a way not just to participate in agricultural life, but actually to bring like dollars, like to bring money into the workforce. But yeah, it's very controversial whether or not it actually worked, because like you said, a lot of the women were much younger. And so a lot of women were actually being taken away from, for example, educational opportunities to be sent to silk mills. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword.
There's a lot of scholarship on this topic. Like this, when you look up the silk industry in Lebanon, at least half of the scholarship that I've come across is about specifically labor and about class and gender and sort of it being an interesting flattener, but also creating more disparities. And before the silk industry, my understanding is that there wasn't really like industry in the way we think of it in terms of like plants that are producing stuff and shipping it. That just wasn't the architecture of, you know, Ottoman Lebanon, Mount Lebanon before the silk industry.
Yeah. And that's why, I mean, you know, when you research the silk industry, as, you know, as I remember it, and, you know, a lot of people always want to look into that, there's kind of two things that appear. There's always the sort of gendered factor and how that relates to sort of the evolution of women. And then there's the famine, which is the other kind of big elephant in the room. And I think it's actually one of the reasons why people didn't really like to look into the silk industry that much until more recently, just like they didn't like to think about the famine too much until more recently, because yeah. those two things are so tightly related. So it, basically, it's the fact that the economy was dominated by monoculture that meant that the moment that you could no longer export silk, you basically starved, because all of agricultural land, which in Mount Lebanon is actually very scarce, was 100% dedicated to silk production, which, like you said, you couldn't eat. And so that was, I think, a huge lesson for the Lebanese, but also in a weird way, it's tied up in the shame of the famine. And so it was never fully, you know, I think it took a long time for people to really revisit that part of the history, I think.
Maybe, Rami, before we end, Denise, we didn't get to these two slides, your final two slides, just the further reading and your contact details.
Oh, sorry.
At the yes. hour.
Yes.
So
further reading. Yeah. So I would definitely suggest visiting the website of Sous Silk Museum, or if you can go in person, it's one of the best places in Lebanon and they have great knowledge. And then I've also included two other books. One is a more comprehensive history, and they have sections which, you know, touch upon the silk industry. And so those are just two suggestions. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Denise.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. We have new episodes coming every single week. Make sure you follow us on social media, on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. You can find us at afikra.com for information about all upcoming events. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot. See you next time, and stay curious.